Welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. If you're passionate about mastering self-leadership, then you're in the right place. I have always been curious about and fascinated by the pursuit of leadership excellence. This is why I pursued my PhD in psychology with a specialization in business, and I've continued to dedicate my career to understanding the science and practice of positive leadership. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm a best-selling author, award-winning keynote speaker, executive coach, and member of the Forbes Coaches Council. Each week, I'll bring you world-class content on the science and practice of positive leadership. Through my conversations with best-selling authors, TED speakers, and top CEOs, you'll be able to leverage their insights and experience so you can maximize your potential and be the leader the world needs you to be. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Do Good to Lead Well webinar and podcast series. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm the host of the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. Really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to join us today. I just received word on the weekend that now Do Good to Lead Well is rated in the top 2% of podcasts in the world, according to Listen Notes. So thank you so much. And this is in no small part because of the amazing guests we've been able to have on the program. And I am exceptionally excited to welcome Doug Colin back to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast series. I will not be able to do Doug's bio justice today, not even close. I'll provide some highlights. So he's the only Fortune 500 CEO who is a New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestselling author, a top 50 leadership innovator, a top 100 leadership speaker, and one of the 100 most influential authors in the world. He's had a 45-year career defined by achieving high performance through an intentional commitment to studying, improving, and spreading the tenets of leadership that works. And I cannot recommend enough that you right away go on his website, access the resources, pick up the books. Just absolutely fantastic. He is the founder and CEO of Conant Leadership, former president and CEO of Campbell Soup Company, former president of Nabisco Foods, and former chairman of Avon Products. He's also served on multiple corporate boards, including AmerisourceBergen and RHR International. His latest Wall Street Journal bestselling book, co-authored with Amy Fetterman, is The Blueprint, 6 Practical Strategies to Lift Your Leadership to New Heights. And I also have to say, a special moment for me. In mid-May, Doug moderated an exceptional panel at the North American Business Summit in Washington, D.C., where he shared his experience and insight in talent management, leadership development trends for now, as well as in the future. So Doug, an absolute warm welcome to the program. And I got to meet your 3D self as opposed to the avatar.
Well, there you go. And I must say, I hope we have enough time for the podcast now. That went on a while, but I'm excited to be here. And, you know, these are challenging times, but exceptional leaders can make an exceptional difference. And now's when people need to step up. And what I'm encouraged by is that people like yourself are filling the gap between where people are today and where they hope to be tomorrow with some good practical advice about how to lift their game. You know, way back in the dark ages, when we still rode around in covered wagons, we didn't have access to this kind of real-time helpful information from people who have been there and done that. And you're serving an important function here, and I'm happy to be part of it today.
Well, thank you, Doug, and I have so much respect for you. So throughout the work, and this is something that I love about your orientation, is that several words that I read continuously, and when I hear you speak and your books, the blog posts that you share, it's really around intentionality. For us to be at our best, it's important to identify tangible steps that we can take and ensure that we can have the impact that we're looking for. As you said, we're in really challenging times. So when you look at leadership and the amazing work that you're doing out of Conant Leadership, what are some of the key topics that you see coming up in terms of top of mind for leaders and executives? And what are some of the skills that you would say are vitally important for us as we move into this future?
Let's define the situation a little bit, and then we'll talk about how we address it. several years ago, actually back in 1987, Warren Bennis, one of my mentors, coined the phrase that it was a VUCA world, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And that was in 1987, before the internet. Today, it's a VUCA world on steroids with all the, there's more coming at us faster than ever before. And we have to be at the top of our game to deal with it. This generation of leaders has actually coined a new word. It's called BANI, B-A-N-I. And those letters stand for brittle, anxious, nonlinear, and incomprehensible. That's the way a cultural psychologist would talk about the environment today in a word, BANI. Brittle, anxious, nonlinear, incomprehensible. So that's the world we're operating in. And I would say today, the single most important letter in that BANI acronym is anxious. I believe anxiety is at an all-time high. As I said earlier, there's more coming at us than ever before, and it's coming faster. It means we have to be at the top of our game. Now, for a leader, what does that mean? What does that imply? To me, it implies that we can't do this by the seat of our pants anymore. You know, when I started as a leader, most leadership stuff, people went to business school and maybe studied a little on leadership, but most of it was by the seat of your pants. And you did the best you could. You looked at the people around you and you tried to learn from what they did right and avoid what they did wrong and get better. You did the best you could. But given the way the situation's rapidly changing, I don't think you can get away with leading by the seat of your pants anymore. When I went into the workforce a long time ago, there were two generations at work, old white men and older white men. And today, six going on seven different generations in the workplace, a beautiful multicultural mosaic of people contributing and gender-wise and culturally. And it's complicated. And with all that complexity, I think a leader needs to kind of go to school a little bit more and get really well anchored in their convictions so that they can lead with courage. I'm going to be doing a summit in September, all focused on courage, which I think is the single biggest challenge we have right now for leaders. Well, for all of us, really. We all have to lead a life. And I think it's hard to have the courage of your convictions if you don't know what your convictions are. So what we challenge leaders to do is really get well anchored in what they want to stand for. And you have to think about that and feel your way through that, which is what the Blueprint book is all about, so that you can be so well anchored in your intentions that when push comes to shove and you're challenged, you know where you stand. I got to say, when I was a junior leader, a junior manager, I didn't know where I was standing. I was sort of equivocating. I wasn't sure, should I do this or that? And how do I manage? You have to be able to stand up and be counted now as a leader. So you have to build the courage muscle. To build the courage muscle, you got to build your sense of conviction around what matters most. And that's what we did the blueprint for. It demands, the word you used was intentionality, and it ultimately demands courage. And our whole philosophy around leadership today for the leaders of today is the only way out of this mess is to go in. You have to go inside yourself and really uncover what matters most to you and then find a way to bring that forth in a way that is effective with the outside world. But you have to start out inside before you can be effective outside. And you know what's cool about that is that we can all do that. There's so much we can't change. There's so much we can't do with the environment all around us. But this is something we can do. We can have complete control of, with our introspection and with our commitment to being the best version of ourselves that we can be given the circumstances. And we find that when people lean into that notion and try and become the best version of themselves that they can be, they can lead, believe it or not, a joyful, fulfilling, and an impactful life amidst the chaos that's all around them. But they have to be well anchored. And that's what this is all about for leaders of today. You got to be incredibly well anchored to what matters most to you.
And in the blueprint, you talk about how courage is the mother skill. And right away, I've got a question from Steve and loves the concept of being anchored in what matters. So his concern is worried about choosing wrong, like, or what happens if what anchors me changes? How, any advice around how to navigate that?
Hey, it will change. The reality is, you know, look, life is very Darwinian. We are very Darwinian. The notion is you either grow or die. And we always encourage people to choose the former, not the latter, growth. It beats the alternative. And as you grow and learn and develop more wisdom, you will make other choices. You know, that will happen. So I'm on probably my third leadership model, my leadership philosophy. I'm on the third version of that in the last 20 years. And it looks very different than the first one. I'm growing. The situation is changing. You know, there's a whole volume of work on situational leadership that says, look, you've got to be fluent in addressing the current situation. And while a lot of the principles are the same, the nuances are very different. So first of all, you accept the fact that things will change and you build that into your approach. I intend to grow. And then I think you can be anchored to principles, and everybody knows what they are. If they do a deep dive on their life story, the first thing we encourage people to do is write your life story and don't leave anything out. When you do that, you're going to uncover some amazing epiphanies about what you've experienced so far. And you're going to realize that you sort of put those in the parking lot as you were off trying to meet the needs of everybody at work. Everybody that you're traveling the journey with, you're so focused on meeting their needs. I mean, you go to work for a company and immediately you have a performance review that says, here are the 13 things you should do to make things work in our company. Nowhere does it say what matters most to you. It just matters what's most important to the company. And what we're saying is you've got to first get anchored in what matters most to you. And you're going to find out that there are some time-honored principles there that are probably the most grounding principles that you could have in life. You get in touch with those. Those won't change. But how you apply those will change profoundly. So evolve or die, and accept the fact that, you know, what works today might not work tomorrow. It ought to be consistent with my principles, but the application may be different today than it was. Certainly would be different today than it was 5 years ago before COVID. We're on a new world, right? Uncharted waters. So accept the change, stay principle-centered, and realize that applications may change dependent on the situation.
Well, and thank you. I've got so many comments here about loving the passion and the energy, Doug, that you're exhibiting for leadership.
Oh, we're just getting warmed up, Craig.
This is the appetizer. And I love that point. So many great quotes in the book. And I love how you talk about how our life story is our leadership story. And I love how you talk about deconstructing that, because there are lessons in that for us in terms of who we are. And I love how you bring that emphasis on being the best version of ourselves.
I was fired from a job when I was in my early 30s. I had to go home, tell my wife, our two small children, and our one very big mortgage that things were changing. I ended up going to an outplacement counselor, and the first significant thing we went through was he had me write my life story. He said, you're not in touch with the real Doug Conant. You're so busy trying to meet the needs of everybody else. You're not in touch with who you are. I want to know who you are. And man, that was life-changing. That was, you know, one of the 10 most important highlights of my career was going through that. He made me handwrite my life story and my family story, putting as much as I could into the work. And when you're unemployed, you have time to do that. I handwrote 50 pages on lined paper, front and back, small handwriting. Wow. I just couldn't believe. And here I had lost my job, but half of my family had come over here from the Irish potato famine. The other half had come to the United States to escape religious persecution in England. And I had lost my job. Oh, poor, pitiful me. you know, I learned that I came from incredibly resilient roots, people who knew what challenge was and persevered and found their way through. And I drew a lot of strength from that. And everyone we teach this work to that goes into their life story finds these nuggets of these powerful nuggets that are mission critical to their leadership journey. So that's where you start. Your life story is your leadership story. And that's a part of the philosophy of the only way out of this is to go in. And that's where you start.
Got another question from Carly, who says, really appreciate that you highlighted anxiety as the critical element of Bonnie. Any thoughts or advice around how about managing the heightened anxiety in our teams, in our organizations? How do you navigate that?
Well, in my first book, Touch Points, we touched on it in the blueprint too, the second one. I think the key here is to lead by listening. I'm talking to, as you are, I'm talking to people every day, leaders in one field or another, or CEOs or people I'm coaching or mentoring or teaching. And anxiety is the number one concern. And I'm going to make a generalization here, but nobody's listening. And part of that is people aren't comfortable sharing. I think we have to be incredibly sensitive to the human condition and really probative in terms of our conversations with people about what's working, what's not, and what's needed, both from a business perspective, but also from a personal perspective. So job one of a leader is to lead by listening, especially today. Make sure people know that they can be heard. So once you go through that barrier, then you've got to be incredibly clear with your communication to reduce anxiety. And okay, I understand you're listening. Now, what are you asking me to do? And then as a leader, the second challenge is to be incredibly clear. Clarity is next to godliness in this game, because people, you know, I'm going to generalize again, but virtually everyone that works for or with you wants to do the right thing. Our job is to tell them what we think the right thing is, and then to invite them to make it better. But the challenge for leaders today is to be clear. That's hard because there's so many shifting sands, but the more clear you can be, the more effective you can be. Lead by listening and then be clear. Yeah. And then you know what you do? You listen some more and it's a little clearer. And you realize that this is a journey, not a destination. So it's the two-way dialogue with the people that work for and with you, always with a spirit of doing a little bit better today than we did yesterday. It's a continuous improvement game. Listen. In Touch Points, we talked about listen, frame, advance. Listen to what's going on, frame the issue, and then help the people you work with advance it. You don't have to solve it. You have to move it forward. And let them own it, but listen carefully. And so I think that's still a very appropriate.
It's such a great insight around the listening, leading with listening. And I hear this consistently. Everyone seems to be talking and very few people are listening. Or even if they're listening, it's more of just not talking while someone's talking, rather than, as you say, absorbing what's going on and then framing the issue effectively. I think that's just vital. And the clarity piece, just yesterday I had a conversation where someone was talking about this and they had said to someone on their team, like, clean up the budget, and then realized, well, what does that mean? And we had this rich conversation about, to your point about clarity, well, that could mean 10 different things for what exactly are the right steps to take.
And you don't have to be perfectly clear. You just have to be one step more clear than you might otherwise have been. A lot of leaders say, oh, I have to be clear. And then they want to go down the ledger and deal with every number. I'll be clear. I'll tell you. No, this speaks to a blog I'm working on called Conant's Theory of Relativity. Most people aren't clear enough. You just have to be 1 degree more clear than you have been, and people will appreciate that. If you go into every conversation with a commitment to being 1 degree more clear than you might have been otherwise, and then you do that tomorrow and the next day, in the fullness of time, your clarity will go up. So you don't have to be perfect. I think Jim Collins used to talk about how great was the enemy of good, or something like that, because people were so busy trying to be great, they weren't very good. And he said, look, you just want to be good and get better. And in the fullness of time, the compound interest from that effort, persistent effort to be good, will make you great. And I think that's true for leaders.
And I really appreciate, Doug, your emphasis on, well, let's get to understand each other and let's get to understand the other's perspective. And that's such a critical part of lowering the emotional temperature, that anxiety. I think that's such brilliant insight.
Well, now, Amy Edmondson's about to publish a book. They're a professor at Harvard Business School, and I think this year or last year was the number one management thinker in the world. And she's about to publish a book called The Right Kind of Wrong. And it's all about learning. And all leaders, this is true of all leaders are wrong. They are. I mean, we're all wrong. We're human. And so you just have to learn from it and just not make the same mistakes over and over again. So realize that it's okay to make a mistake if it's genuine, principle-based, and you just own it and you move on. If you're not being responsive to this fast-changing environment, people are not going to follow you. So you got to be responsive to it, but then you have to say, you know, I'm doing the best I can, and we might make a mistake, but then we're going to course correct. Years ago, McKinsey published an article saying there was no true competitive advantage anymore for any company. The only competitive advantage was organization agility. You're going to make mistakes. You just got to be faster at addressing them than the other guy. Part of Conant's theory of relativity. You know, you're going to make mistakes. You just own them and move on.
Absolutely. And love the connection back to the principled aspect, because Ian has a question around that. And really appreciated that exercise of being clear on our principles, our values. So how important is it to explicitly communicate those to the teams and organizations you lead?
Oh, you're in my sweet spot now. You thought you were in my sweet spot already. Now we're there, baby. No, you know, it's amazing to me. Believe it or not, people are not mind readers. We tend to think that the people that work for us know what we want and know where we stand on things. I don't know about you, but I worked for 28 bosses in my career, and they had 28 bosses. So that's 56 bosses that I had that I had good visibility to in the office, visibility to. I got to tell you, there were most bosses, I didn't know what they wanted. It took me like 3 months to figure out what's the game here and how am I supposed to respond to this or that. That's just unnecessarily anxiety promoting. So I have this belief, and we've talked about it in both my books and a little off on my website and the blogs. I believe that a leader needs to declare himself or herself. And I have a practice of telling people how I think and where I stand on things the first hour of the first day we work together. First hour, first day. And some people I've shared it with before I've hired them. I also share it with my bosses. I didn't develop the habit until late in my career, but I shared it with my CEO or my chairman. I said, here's what I think. And I share with them what matters most to me, including my family, how I think about how I run my businesses, the principles that I hold dear. And I share all that in the first hour of the first day. And then I say, now, hopefully you're going to see that I'm going to be behaving in a way that is aligned with what I've just shared with you. If I'm not, I guess you can't trust me. And you'll know that. You'll know that. But I'm betting you're going to see that what you see is what you get here. And now that we've had this conversation, believe me, I don't want to disappoint you. I must say, in that conversation, I talk about having high standards for people, including myself, and that performance matters, and that we have to perform at a very high level. And so I believe as a leader, you got to tell people where you stand. And guess what? You probably got to overdo it and make sure, in the spirit of clarity that we talked about a little while ago, that it's crystal clear. So they're not going to be wondering, well, what does she want me to do? Well, she told you. It opens things up. And then the other thing I would say, I think as a leader, you lead with that, but then you invite anybody who works for you to come back and share with you what their beliefs are. And it's no pressure. They don't have to. But I would say that about half the time people come back and share with me, here's what I believe. Here's how I work best. I had a guy who I hired to run food service at Nabisco, who Cracker Jack executive. I thought I knew everything about him. I didn't. And I did this exercise the first hour of the first day. And he said, Doug, I wasn't prepared for this conversation, but since you've opened the door, part of the reason I took this job is that my wife and I have just divorced. And I wanted to be closer to the family. And I want to be close to my two boys. I want to be able to go to their games. I want to be able to go to the teacher conferences. And he said, if you can accommodate me a little bit with this, because I told him family mattered most in the orientation, he said, you know, I'd appreciate it. And I said, no problem. We'll make this work for you. Take it to the bank. And you know what? We did. And he shot the lights out for us because we had opened a door for him. And we had created, again, Conan's theory of relativity, one level deeper dialogue with him than he had ever experienced before with a company. And it opened up the door to high performance at an amazing level. I think that kind of thing can happen if a leader models that behavior and then invites the people that work for them to share their agenda with the leader.
And this is why I love hosting the podcast, because I had the profound privilege to collaborate with Alan Mulally, the former CEO of Ford, on my latest book. And then he talked about authentic leadership being when our values, beliefs, and behaviors are in alignment, and the only thing people see, exactly to your point, are behaviors. And that's a critical part. And I love that you highlight that, because people right away are going to see our behaviors and make assumptions about what our values and beliefs are.
Yeah, Alan and I have drunk from the same faucet. He and I are very aligned. We've talked about it. He's an exceptional leader.
I love speaking with you both for that very reason. And again, and what I think is so profoundly, not just important, inspiring for everybody joining today, is that you've led such extraordinary organizations, the most well-known brands and largest, most complex organizations in the world. And looking at this through a people-first lens about being connected to who we are and our values. And I think that's so critical, because in a lot of conversations or a lot of coverage, that can get lost in the discussion.
Well, and it does. And when I was starting my career, when I first became a CEO, Jack Welch was just retiring. And the model was really a shareholder value creation model. And it was all about being tough-minded. Tough. That never sat well with me. It was part of the equation, but not all of it. My equation back then and now is that, you know what? We do have to be tough-minded on standards of performance. We do. Otherwise, we're not going to have our jobs very long. Organizations are counting on us. But at the same time, there's an and in here. We have to be tough-minded on standards of performance and tender-hearted with people. Yeah. It's not one or the other. This is the spirit of abundance. We have to be wildly caring about our people and wildly caring about the performance of our enterprise. And you know what? I found after doing this for 45 years now, you can do both. And in fact, it's sort of inconceivable to me, if you want to create an enduring success model, it's inconceivable to me that you can be saying to people, we want you to care about the agenda of our company, but we don't care about your agenda as a person. Yes. Won't work. Not in a sustainable way. Won't work. I found the more I care about the people I work with, the better we do. But we have to have high standards. We have to perform. And we can find our way through that.
And I think that's such an important point. And I wanted to speak with you about this, because you have such great comments and observations in the book. And in your blog post on your website around the genius of the and. So that's a great. So talk to us a little bit more around how and is such a powerful word when it comes to effective, strong leadership.
Well, you know, this is not a new thought. I was given the gift of this thought in its fullness by Stephen Covey. He helped me develop my thinking around leadership the last two decades of his life. And he was the one who would talk about and. And the other person was Jim Collins, who coined the phrase, in my experience, genius of the and. And the three of us were together at an event right after 9/11. That year, it was September 11th, and we were at an event in Utah, in December. As soon as you could be traveling again, we were at an event together, and we got into the power of and, because people were thinking in limited ways. And we said, no, we have to continue to have high standards, but we can't lose sight of the people. And that's what the genius of the and is all about. Here's an example. We're all parents, or else we're the child of parents. And so when we think about when we are at our best as parents, or when our parents were at their best with us, I would tell you that 99 out of 100 times when I have these conversations, the individual will say, well, did your parents have high standards for you? Your grandparents, your aunt, your uncle, whoever was important to you, did they have high standards for you? Well, absolutely. I didn't want to disappoint them. Well, did they care about you? Absolutely. They loved me to death. They loved me, and they had high standards for me, and that brought out the best in me. We all have those moments. And as a leader, that's sort of the moment we want to create for the people that we work with. We want them to be at their best. That's the best way to bring the genius of the and to life for an individual. We all have those moments where somebody we profoundly respect, and certainly in a moment, had high standards and cared. It wasn't either or, it was both and. I find virtually all the leaders who have been wildly successful, I always say in an enduring way, episodically, a leader can be successful, come and gone. But if you want to have enduring success, the only way from here to there is to adopt an abundance mentality.
And I love how you approach that, because then that unlocks more of an abundance approach. And one of the things, and in the book as well, you've talked about the importance of leading from an abundance mindset. And in this really anxious world that can kind of provoke almost a scarcity mindset, people wrestling for resources. Talk to us about what is it that makes leading with an abundance mindset so important, and the opportunities that that unlocks for us.
Well, let's first say everything is not an and. I mean, we have either or decisions we make every day. It's either this number or it's that number. Those decisions are made every day. But when you get to the most substantial issues of the day, and it's not just business, it's cultural and it's relational, relationship oriented, culturally oriented, or business oriented, the substantial issues, I think they benefit from abundant thinking and the genius of the and. But let's be clear. I mean, you know, probably 70% of the decisions we all make every day are either or decisions. Go see him or go see her, or make this call or don't make the call. Things are happening. We have to make choices. Understand that. But on the most significant issues, I think you just want to test out the abundant thinking before you defer that and just go to the either or decision making. So recognize that you're making choices all the time. And 70, I'm making up the number, but it feels about right to me. 7 out of 10 are either or. But be aware that there are 3 out of 10 that sort of probably deserve a little more thought, and discriminate there.
Well, I really appreciate the intentionality around that, taking that moment of pause and that separation, saying, okay, so those most strategic, the most impactful, the relational, the cultural, let's take a moment to pause, reflect, and think about that. I've got another question from Chris, who was wondering, sometimes I love, really appreciate the tough, you know, have high standards and then be soft on people. Sometimes worry that too soft in those conversations. So any advice around how you can find, do that effectively, maintain the tough standards, some reflection questions or ways to ensure that you're balancing those?
Well, the first thing is I didn't say soft. That's inferred.
Right.
But I think you do have to be tough-minded on standards. I think you have to be sensitive to people. That's why I say tender-hearted. And that's also why I start out with, here's the standard, because people need to know what's expected in the spirit of clarity. You have to be tough-minded on standards, and you have to be sensitive to people. But if they're not getting the job done and they need help, it requires a candid conversation about what's not working and how can we make it work better. And let's try it this way. Let's try it that way. And if we can't make that work, maybe we have to change your responsibilities a little bit. It always felt to me, and this is my own on my own personal experience, that there was an elephant in the room that we were dancing around in these conversations around performance. Managers were trying to be sensitive and they weren't talking about what they really wanted or how you were really doing. They wanted you to feel good, but know that you didn't do good. I don't know. It was too confusing. Of course, I'm dense, so maybe that was just me. But I just think you have to show empathy for the individual. And then you have to work with that individual to meet the standard. Mm-hmm. But it's about empathy. It's not about being soft. And, you know, our job is to lead the enterprise to higher ground. I don't care if it's for-profit, not-for-profit, public service. Our job is to help lead the enterprise to higher ground and to help the people that we're working with what is going to be a very heavy lift. And it's not about being nice. It's about being caring and empathetic.
Doug, the notion of starting with the standard and being, and it reminds me of earlier when we talked about the clarity, because I find a lot of those conversations, the standard for performance is not clear. And then that makes it really, really challenging. And I really appreciate the point about leading with empathy. It's not about being soft. It's about being understanding and getting information and figuring out different ways to approach this. And at the same time, the standard is still in the background that we must uphold and move forwards and figure out how we get there. I think that's such a critical leadership insight.
Yeah. And let me say also that, you know, if you're not clear with the standard, then you end up working with a different standard for every person. And that's dangerous because everybody's watching. How are you dealing with her or him relative to me? It's got to be as clear as it can be that there's a standard for performance here that that I hold myself to, that we hold our team to, that we hold every individual to. It gets awfully messy if you don't deal with it from a perspective of the standard. Now, the other piece of this is that leaders are not comfortable with the soft stuff. They say the hard stuff is the soft stuff. Most people haven't derailed because they didn't get the number right. It's because there was a misunderstanding, of some kind. And so what we're trying to do is realize that the soft stuff is the hard stuff. And that as leaders, we have to be as clear as can be around the standards for the soft stuff so that we can deal with them in a way that helps people move forward and where there aren't surprises later on because they didn't understand what was expected. And they didn't understand that there's a logical consequence to not meeting the standard.
Well, and again, it reminds me of, and it's so great that you talked about the conversations, those open, respectful conversations and talking, and really appreciate the framing of, you know, not talking about the elephant in the room, even though it's there. And then it just undermines progress. It undermines our ability to be able to connect and understand and rally together, work together towards that desired future.
Yeah.
So critical. I've got another, we're almost at 10 minutes remaining. It's amazing how fast the time goes. So much great content here. So Ellen was wondering, their organization, unfortunately, because of some of the challenging headwinds, have had some layoffs and downsizing. And so any thoughts around how to regain, rebuild trust and how to approach having candid conversations in that kind of environment?
And I think, you know, the time to build trust is before you need it. So ideally, and we're going to talk about this issue in a minute, but ideally you've built so much trust up in your organization that when you do have downsizing, people get it and they get that you care about them and they know you really don't have any choice, okay? So the most important thing on this trust building notion is the time to have it is before you need it. You gotta build the trust in advance. It's a lot like Stephen Covey's old language around the emotional bank account. You want to make sure that your bank account with your culture, with your people, is so much in the black that even if you make a giant withdrawal, a layoff, you're still in the black. You're not in the red, okay? What that says is, as a leader, trust building has to be the number one thing you do. Number one. And how you build trust is by being extremely competent at what you do with great character, and you do it well with others. Those three things combined enable you to build trust in the fullness of time. We could talk all day about trust building. But the most important thing, if there's this sense of mistrust, what I have found is, and I've been in two horrible environments, one right after Barbarians at the Gate, world's largest LBO, RJR Nabisco. It was a mess. The emotional bank account was way in the red. And then the other one was going to Campbell Soup, and it was in a difficult situation. What we had to do to build trust was to ask people what they needed and to care, and then to act on that in a way that was visible. I'll use an example at Campbell. We were headquartered in the poorest, most dangerous city in the United States, Camden, New Jersey. 75,000 people, 70 murders a year in a little town. Dangerous. Our facility was surrounded by razor wire, and it was in a poor, dilapidated state. So we had to ask people what they needed. They wanted a facility they could be proud of. We couldn't afford to do anything, but you know what we could do? We could clean it up. We could paint the curbs again. We could make it more welcoming on a lot of with small steps. And then we could build on those small steps and make it more welcoming in the fullness of time. So we asked the employees what they wanted, and then we gave it to them and made sure they knew it was what we could do at the time and that we were committed to doing more, better, faster in the future. And again, it was Conant's theory of relativity. We were relatively more engaged and more responsive than anybody they'd ever seen at the executive level. And they started to value that. And they said, well, you know, they sort of do what they say they're going to do. And then they asked me, what's next? What should we do next? At the same time, we were saying, we're in a deep hole. We have to have high standards here. We have to lift our performance too. But we're going to do everything we can to create the conditions for you to thrive in this environment. And we're all in this together. So I think you want to invite them in, find out how you can improve the situation, and then take small steps, then tell them what you've done, and then ask them what else, what's next? What should we do next? The other thing I would say that was a surprise to me, I got tired of doing this. As a CEO, I had to keep telling them what we were doing because they would forget what we told them 3 months earlier. And they would do, well, what have you done for me lately? Well, we just finished painting the curbs. We just finished taking down the razor wire. We just finished creating a more welcoming environment here. And here we go. We're doing more. But I found you had to keep telling people what you were doing. The last piece is, I believe you can't manage it if you don't measure it. So you have to ask your employees. We used the Gallup Q12 survey for over a decade every year, and we had them basically they were voting on how we were doing through engagement. And every year we would have one of our 650 different work groups we had would identify, here's the results from our last survey. What three things do we want to address this year to make it better in our work group? Over only three things. You couldn't take on more because you'd never get them done. And they had to be doable within that year. But over a decade, each group got 30 things done. And we got 30 things done as a company. And we became a machine at doing things, measuring how we were doing, learning from that, and then doing better. And over a decade, we changed the culture at Campbell, went from the lowest engagement in the Fortune 500 to the highest engagement. So there are some tips in there.
This has just been so jam-packed with great questions and great insights, Doug. So when you look at the future of leadership and being at the head of Cohen Leadership, and where do you see things heading? What are your thoughts around the future of leadership?
I'm very optimistic. The young people I'm working with, next generation leaders, they have the eye of the tiger. And you know what? They're not stuck in an old paradigm. You and I, I won't talk about you. I'll talk about me. I was stuck in a hierarchical World War II hierarchy, a model with all men. That's what I grew up with. And that was sort of how the world worked. Thank God the world doesn't work that way anymore. It's open. Now, the open architecture does create more anxiety, but I would say it also creates more opportunity. And we will make mistakes with it, but our young leaders have the eye of the tiger. They want to build a better world. And I think they will. They've got to be careful, though, because they will make mistakes. Some of the leaders that I coach, I'm just shocked at some of the choices they make. And they just don't know any better. They haven't been on the journey that I've been on. But I'm also blown away at some of the choices they are making that are changing the world. So we're going to make mistakes, but I'm optimistic that this next generation has the eye of the tiger, wants to change the world. It's not easy. No, it wasn't easy when I was doing it either. I mean, guess what? There's a reason you get paid to do these jobs, and they're not easy. You're dealing with the human condition under stress. Guess what? That's hard. I've got a family of five. We can't get five of us to agree on anything, you know? And now you're the leader of a group of 500, and you want to get all of them on the same page? Not easy. So give yourself a break, but keep the eye of the tiger. Keep trying to build a better world, and you will. You will.
Well, thank you. I couldn't think of a better closing. I thank you so much for your energy, your service, your thoughtfulness, how you coach, mentor, develop future generations of leaders. And I'm always inspired when we speak. I always learn new things and just absolutely value our relationship and how you go about and who you are and what you do. So I think that's great. Doug, thank you so much. This was absolutely awesome. It's always an absolute pleasure.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me. And it's always good to see you again. Next time I'll get my desktop or my laptop working so we don't have to work off my iPad. But anyway, it worked. We're here together and I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you so much. Take care, everyone. Look to see you soon. Bye for now. Thank you so much for joining me here today on Do Good to Lead Well. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Dowden or reach out via LinkedIn or email info@craigdowden.com. I look forward to meeting you here next week for another transformational episode.